Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
As an acute threat, the pandemic departed a couple of years ago. The Pandemic Relief Accountability Committee has another year and a half to go, though. It's scheduled to sunset in September of 2025. And now a bipartisan Senate bill would help the government retain the data analytics platform so it would still be available to inspectors general. For why this all matters, we turn to the Justice Department Inspector General and PRAC Chairman, Michael Horowitz, who joins me in studio. Michael, good to have you back.
Great to be here again, Tom.
And let's begin with the PRAC assets. What does it possess that should be preserved here?
There are a few things. First of all, the most important asset, of course, of any organization is its people. And we've been able to assemble a tremendously talented group of people, particularly in the analytics space, among all the different responsibilities we have. We were given unique hiring authorities by Congress when the pandemic hit. So we've brought on a wide range of statisticians, analysts, people with great statistical skills who've helped us build this analytics platform, which is our other most important asset beyond our people, is this effort to get data from across the federal government on the pandemic. So your listeners know there were over 400 programs set up in the various relief bills that Congress passed involving $5 trillion. That's with a T, $5 trillion. It's hard to believe. And we learned pretty quickly the only way you can do effective oversight over $5 trillion of spending is with analytics.
Right. So there is an analytics piece of software somewhere, hosted somewhere, that belongs to the PRAC right. as a temporary committee.
Right. In 2021, Congress gave us funding to build this analytics platform, which we created, we've developed, we've brought in a range of data into it for these various pandemic programs. We've also entered into agreements with various agencies so we could get additional data from them so that we could look to find where the hundreds of billions of dollars in fraud occurred and make sure we can track down the wrongdoers on the one hand. On the other hand, also understand and look at the systemic issues that occurred here, which is obviously a very important part of what we've been doing as well.
So this bill that has the backing of a couple of senators, I think Mitt Romney is on the Republican side. And
Chairman Peters on the Democratic side, as well as Senator Lankford.
And it would do what exactly?
So we are scheduled to sunset the Pandemic Response Accountability Committee in September of next year. What the bill would do is, first of all, extend the existence of the PRAC beyond that. It would change the name to the Government Spending Oversight Committee, and it would allow us to keep the analytics platform to not only look at pandemic spending, continuing to look at pandemic spending, but also expand it to cover other programs as well so that we could broaden its use. And keep in mind, the statute limitations for pandemic fraud was extended by Congress for small business-related fraud to 10 years. So we're scheduled to sunset a little more than 5 years since the CARES Act was passed in March 2020. But the prosecutors and investigators are allowed to pursue the fraud until at least 2030.
So if this bill would become law then, it's almost as if the PRAC would become a small independent agency in some ways.
So we would stay as part of the IG Council, but as a different committee and an operational committee, if you will. So this would be an operational arm of the IGs that would allow us to assist all of the IGs as they pursue fraud in other areas beyond the pandemic.
Because the analytical platform, I guess, is agnostic as to what program or spending that it covers, fair to say.
That's correct. I mean, we could be using this for any purpose. And what we are looking to do and what the bill would allow us to do is use it to prevent fraud. One of the things we've been able to use it to demonstrate to policymakers is how agencies could have taken steps and how Congress could have taken steps to put in place stronger controls to prevent the fraud before it occurred.
Sure. We're speaking with Michael Horowitz, Inspector General at the Justice Department and Chair of the Pandemic Response Accountability Committee. And we've been through this before because the spending for the 2008 housing financial relief a mechanism was created, and it was disbanded. And I believe early on, Prac said, I wish we had what they had built in 2008.
Right.
So in some ways, it sounds like this is an effort to prevent that from happening.
That's exactly right, Tom. When I became chair of the current committee, one of the first things I did was reach back out to the folks who ran the Recovery and Accountability Transparency Board, which was created to oversee the funding during the financial crisis in 2008-9 going forward. One of the things they built was something called the ROC, the Recovery Operations Center, an analytics platform that was tremendously valuable. When I became an inspector general in 2012, I was on this recovery board, and I saw it work. Well, when 2015 came around and the recovery board was scheduled to sunset, just like we're scheduled to sunset, we, as IGs, the Comptroller General, Gene Dodaro, went to Congress and said, and to the administration, and said, you should keep this analytics platform. In fact, GAO has a report out there in 2015 your readers can find on GAO's website that lays out the case for it. Unfortunately, neither the administration nor Congress did that. Fast forward 5 years later, the pandemic hits. We don't have an analytics platform. And yeah. Congress has to invest $40 million in 2021 to have us rebuild it.
Only the memory of Earl Devaney to try to inspire you, but not the money or the platform. Right. You had the money, but not the platform.
Not only the memory of Earl, I had a chance to talk to Earl about it. He gave me the download on what worked and how it worked.
And in this case, the funding came fairly late in the whole effort because the CARES Act was 2020. Trillions had gone out by the formation of the PRAC and the funding in 2021 until you got it built. Really, the hogs had escaped the barn door.
You know, in 2020, when the CARES Act was passed, agencies decided they were going to get the money out as quickly as they could because of the pandemic with essentially no guardrails. It was just get the money out. And what happened, not surprisingly, is there were hundreds of billions of dollars in fraud, as well as improper payments, which we shouldn't forget. We found billions of dollars went to deceased individuals, for example, that could have easily been identified had agencies simply taken a little bit of time. We put out a fraud alert in early 2022 that went through and identified how billions of dollars in payments could have been stopped had something as simple as taking the applications and asking the Social Security Administration, are these real Social Security numbers? Do these match the names and date of births in your system? We did that.
That's a 10-second match running, basically.
Right. We sent them 2.7 million pieces of information from PPP, Payroll Protection Plan, mm-hmm. SBA program-related applications. 2.7 million. Within 2 weeks, we had the answers back, identifying over 100,000 applications that had incorrect information in them that didn't match what the government already knew about.
And by the way, what's the current status of PRAC activity? Are you still working the platform? The staff still getting data and looking for things?
We are still working. We are doing a couple things. First of all, we're writing a playbook for Congress, for the administration, for policymakers going forward on what worked, what didn't work. How do you go forward? Hopefully, we don't have another pandemic for another 100 plus years. But we're going to have emergency spending. We're going to have hurricanes, earthquakes, you know, fires, all the things that need assistance. And we're writing a playbook for Congress and the administration so they know what worked, what didn't work, and we can hopefully prevent some of what was easily preventable here. That's one thing. Secondly, we're going to continue to go after the fraudsters. We are not going to, as I often say, we're not going to let crime pay. We can't have that happen. We're working closely with the Justice Department. We're working with over 40 law enforcement agencies to go after this fraud. And no one who committed fraud should rest comfortably at this point just because people have started to move on from the pandemic.
But didn't a lot of this fraud actually originate outside the United States? Is it beyond our reach at this point?
It's not beyond our reach, but in fact, it is among the hardest to track down and mm-hmm. follow up on because you need to work with your foreign counterparts. I actually was meeting just 2 weeks ago with my counterpart from the United Kingdom on some of the same challenges and issues and comparing notes with them. And we're going to keep pursuing it. In fact, the Justice Department itself has been strongly supportive of keeping us in business because they need to be able to use our analytics platform to chase these funds. We're supporting almost 800 cases involving $2 billion plus in fraud, our analytics platform.
Wow. So you envision then the PRAC capabilities continuing as almost a service bureau for the IG community via SIGI?
Exactly right. That is exactly how we're trying to structure it, as well as when fraud does occur, agencies like the Secret Service, the FBI, and others, state and local law enforcement, who are pursuing these cases when fraud does occur. We want to work with the IGs to help them identify both programmatic issues and systemic issues, individual issues. But we also, very importantly, are working with OMB to understand how this can be used to prevent fraud, prevent improper payments before they occur. Because all of us know who are in this business that once the money goes out the door, you're lucky if you can get even close to 10% of it back. It's not even going to come close to that, ultimately.
Right. So the key word is not clawback, but prevention, really.
Absolutely.
You'll have it ahead of the next type of crisis.
Exactly right. Well, you have it in place first. You don't spend hundreds of billions of dollars, trillions of dollars in this case, and then come up and say, let's figure out what happened.
Michael Horowitz is Inspector General at the Justice Department and Chairman of the Pandemic Response Accountability Committee. As always, thanks so much for joining me.
Always great to be here, Tom. Thanks.
And we'll post this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Hear the Federal Drive on demand. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective. We get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you've piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions, and that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped, and I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. and even your title, Chief People Officer. What does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture and what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful. So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture, because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career. And that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been married, happily married, for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years, yeah, and worked alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, Have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.